Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we remember veteran newscaster Roger Mudd, a reporter and television journalist who spent over three decades working for CBS, NBC, and PBS. He died last week at the age of 93. Today, Mudd is best known for his 1979 interview with Senator Ted Kennedy that wounded the senator's presidential bid just as his campaign was launching with a very simple question.
Why do you want to be president?
Well, I'm were I to make the announcement and to run, the reasons that I would run is because I have a great belief in this country that it is as more.
Kennedy's hesitation and rambling three-minute answer that never answered the question raised serious doubts about his ability to be president. While Kennedy battled incumbent Jimmy Carter for the Democratic nomination all the way to the convention, Mudd's interview, with the simplest of questions, changed the arc of the race. Mudd was a journalist first, starting in news with the Richmond News Leader, then Washington TV station WTOP. He joined CBS in 1961, covering the Senate filibuster, the Civil Rights Bill in 1964, which brought him to national prominence. He covered all sorts of major stories in Washington and national politics, including the Watergate scandal in the 1970s, and was the heir apparent to succeed Walter Cronkite when he left the CBS Evening News and retired in 1981. But when the network chose Dan Rather instead, he moved to NBC. There he co-anchored the evening news with Tom Brokaw, hosted Meet the Press, and then eventually moved to PBS as a political correspondent and essayist. I spoke with him upon the release of his 2008 memoir, The Place to Be, Washington, CBS, and the Glory Days of Television News. Today, we remember Roger Mudd with this interview. Roger Mudd, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, I'm delighted that you called.
Your new book, The Place to Be, really talks about your time at CBS and what you call the golden age of television news, which the golden age of television was the 1950s, but really for the television news, it was the 1960s. What happened during that time that made it such a special place?
Well, the first thing that happened was that CBS became the first television network to go to 30 minutes with its evening broadcast. The other two networks followed soon after, NBC almost like 2 weeks later, and ABC, I think, another year. But once you got beyond the 15 minutes and went and got into 30 minutes, or really 25 minutes, you had the chance to do better, longer, more varied stories. But in addition to that, in those early days in the 1960s came the development of the Telstar, the satellite, which meant that no longer did you have to depend on the jet plane to get film from Paris to New York, which was 6-7 hours. You could get it by feeding it to the satellite, the bird, they called it back then, in a matter of 30 minutes. And so those two developments, the 30-minute broadcast and this satellite, broke the newspaper's monopoly on breaking news. They could use the telegraph wires for instantaneous transmission of stories, but we had to depend on the jet plane. So that was no longer the case. And suddenly, when anything broke, it broke first on television. And that then enlarged the appetite for more and better stories. And with that came the expansion of news divisions, and particularly of the Washington Bureau of CBS. And before the 60s, were out, we had a bureau the likes of which nobody had ever seen before for its quality and its depth and its sophistication.
It's hard to imagine today in this atmosphere when you have a 24-hour news cycle how expanding a newscast from 15 to 30 minutes made such a difference, but right. but it obviously did.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, it did. Everybody was used to the little 15-minute thing, which was almost like a
headlines in a way.
Well, it's a black kind of a blackboard newscast with still pictures and no film, and very little attempts to go into depth. You remember John Cameron Swayze's phrase "hopscotching around the world." Well, that was about what they did. Yeah. But 30 minutes meant a whole new dimension. And of course, now, as you say, it's you can tune in anytime, any place, and get just endless broadcasts, and much of it sort of meaningless at times. There's so much of it and such a huge craw to fill that everything and anything is put on the air just to fill the time.
There may still only be about 30 minutes of hard news.
I'm sorry?
I said there may still only be about 30 minutes of hard news.
Right, right. Yeah, despite the 24-hour brag about it.
Well, when you came up to CBS, actually, I hadn't even thought about this, but radio was still the most important beat when you first came to CBS News.
Well, it was. There were two really first-class radio broadcasts, the World News Roundup at 8 in the morning Eastern Time, and then at 7 in the evening, The World Tonight. And those two were the premier vehicles for radio. And it was there that you got, when you woke up in the morning or were listening to the radio with breakfast or whatever, it was there you got reports from Paris and London and Rome and Moscow and Tokyo. And it was 15-minute radio broadcast, but it set a standard for good journalism, and it was where really the House of Murrow got built with all those marvelous correspondents that he had put together right after World War II.
You write about the heyday of the desk, the Washington Bureau. It was run by a man named Bill Small.
He was the bureau chief, yes, yeah. The bureau chief. The desk was run by Bill Galbraith. He was the editor, and Small was the bureau chief.
Can you describe the difference between those? The bureau chief, did he...
Well, the bureau chief was the chief executive officer. He was in charge of the bureau. He was in charge of hiring and, in some cases, firing. He went down the list of every assignment each morning. The editor, the desk editor, Bill Galbraith, ran the detailed operation. He dispatched crews to where they belonged. He made sure that crews and correspondents got together. He would prepare each evening after the broadcast, the evening news was over. He would go in with his list of potential stories for the next day. The desk editor would do that. And he would go in Mr. Small's, Bill Small's office, and together they would, with the producers sitting in, they would go over the potential assignments for the next day.
And apparently they were really good at what they did because you write in the book that some of your colleagues, when they switched networks, would find out that their duties were done by, like, a team of people. And that was
Barry Serafin left CBS and went over to ABC, he was introduced to the people, and what do you do and what do you do? And before he finished meeting everybody, he realized that they were all, seven of them were doing the same, very same thing that just one man at CBS was doing, and that was Galbraith. Galbraith never missed a trick.
Mm. And you call that Bill Small was a pretty effective leader because you had all these guys that were always looking for a story, always wanting time on the news. Everybody was hungry for a story, and he kind of was a great Machiavellian character about keeping your egos in check and keeping you always looking for the next story.
Well, he was very talented that way. He was a fine judge of journalistic horseflesh. During his time as bureau chief, he was there, I think, 15 years. He lost only three of the 15, 20, 25 people he hired. But Small, he knew what activated us. He knew good stories. Psychologically, he was very adept at energizing us. He wasn't devious. He just knew how to play one against the other. So in that way, he made competition an honorable form of journalism.
Was the bureau actually laid out in rows where there was sort of a pecking order to the correspondents?
Well, what had happened was that when CBS went to 30 minutes in 62, and the bureau began to enlarge. Don Hewitt, who was then the producer of the evening news, wanted the ability just to wheel one of those big, heavy cameras into the newsroom and roll it across the floor and zero in on one of the correspondents. And so they tried working it out. It never really worked out. They had five or six little cubicles. And in those five cubicles were the five or six of us who were on the air most of the time. That was Dan Rather and Marvin Kalb and
George Herman.
George Herman and me and
Daniel Shore.
And Dan Shore. So they tried it out, and it Leslie Stahl once looked at it and said it looked like we were mannequins in a clothing store window. So they never used that, but that became known as the front row. And in the back hall behind that was the second string. Back there was Shoemaker and Mariah McLaughlin and Bruce Morton. At any other network bureau, that second string would have been the first string. But then upstairs, in some rented offices, were those who had just come and had to work their way downstairs into the second tier.
Huh. And of course, the competition for stories was pretty tough.
Well, it was. What made it worthwhile was that Cronkite believed that what happened in Washington was really important. And he believed that the reporters who reported the stories ought to do the reporting. Unlike NBC, where David Brinkley was so deft at his writing that he began to take over most of the Washington stories. He became the voice of Washington. And as a consequence, his dominating presence on the nightly news meant that you didn't have develop at NBC a front row. There was a front row, like with Brokaw and Dick Valeriani and so forth, but they never got on the air so much because Brinkley would take the story. At CBS, if you had the story, you did the story.
And you stayed on it, too. You write several times the book. You know, CBS at that time offered you a great chance to really learn the ins and outs of your beat, whether it be on a presidential campaign or on Capitol Hill, which was sort of your province a lot of the time.
Yeah.
You really?
Yeah. They once they put you. There were exceptions, of course, in emergencies and things, but once they put you on a beat or assigned you to a story, you stayed with it, and that was one of the great secrets of CBS News. And so we were as sophisticated about our beat and our stories as the newspaper people were, and they knew it. And we gave them as much competition as we gave anybody else. And you know, I was on the Hill for 15 years. And really got to know my way around, and you learned who was important, who to go to, who to trust, what stories would be significant, which stories wouldn't be, who the blowhards were, who the greedy ones were. You learned all that, and so did Calb at the State Department, and Rather at the White House. And the government itself and the agencies themselves knew that we knew what we were talking about. And so when you called and said, Smut of CBS, you know, you got your calls answered.
You write, one of your first big stories at Capitol Hill was covering the filibuster against the Civil Rights Act. This would have been 1964.
Right.
And in fact, there was a great series of stories on the CBS Evening News following the process of this filibuster that went on for, what, 3-4 months, I guess?
Yeah, it was 12 weeks. Sure.
And
was.
You said you learned more about Congress in that 12. It was a great way to really sort of negotiate the sort of inside corridors of the Senate by following that one story.
That's right. And you learned during the process, you learned almost to a point of boring my editors, you learned what the legislative process was. You learned what a certain vote would mean, whether this was a vote that would kill the bill or simply delay the bill, which of the senators were respected, which senators had a voice that was listened to, which senators had a staff that knew what it was talking about, which senators were tough, which senators could be pushed. And it became, for me, in those 12 weeks, a learning experience that I couldn't have duplicated in 3 years had I not been given that one do this and do this only assignment.
Well, as you came to, you know, CBS is known as the Murrow place first, and then it became the Cronkite place. You really weren't of those two sort of cliques, were you, within CBS?
Well, certainly not. I was not an occupant of the House of Murrow. He had left CBS in 61 when Kennedy was inaugurated to run the USIA, and I had I was just coming to CBS during that springtime, and I sort of knew him from a distance. And Cronkite, it never became known as the House of Cronkite, but it became known as the Cronkite Show. So his name, because he was such a hard newsman and so serious about his work and serious about the importance of news, it simply became, that was the dominant name. I think the Murrow boys, Howard K. Smith and Severide and Hoddlett, Bill Downs, had a fairly, I don't want to say low opinion, but had a skeptical opinion of Cronkite. They did not regard him as much of a literary man. They regarded him as a hustling wire service man who punched out his copy but didn't have any great literary grace. And he was aware of that. And as a consequence, the legacy of Murrow never quite enveloped Cronkite. Although those of us who came to work for Cronkite during those years had enormous respect for him simply because he thought the news was the news and you didn't fool around with it.
You write quite a bit about the difference in attitudes between the three shops at that time, CBS, ABC, and NBC. And you guys reflected that personality, Walter Cronkite, as far as going out and hustling, getting the story, getting it on first, competing very aggressively with the other networks to be first. You write that NBC was more of a laid-back place. They would give you the follow-up, not necessarily break the news. And then ABC was just, at that time, really trying to still put its news operation together.
Well, it had, as I mentioned about the Brinkley presence in the NBC Bureau, and I think NBC had been in first place so long with Huntley Brinkley from the early 50s up, I guess it was probably 68 before Cronkite really began to dominate. But during that 10-12 year period, NBC ate everybody's lunch, and I think they got complacent. And I think they were used to being number one, and I don't think they were prepared for the swarm that hit them when CBS got rolling. And so their explanation back then is that, well, we may not be the first to break a story, but on the second day we have the superior stuff. Well, you know, if you're in the news business, you want to be first. You don't want to be good second. You want to be good first. And ABC, as you say, was almost a non-entity for a while, and not until Rune Arledge came in the late 70s, early 80s, and got a big infusion of money, was he able to put together a first-class news operation.
I was struck by the level of competition. There's one passage where you're talking about a presidential news conferences and putting putting the slug underneath the reporters asking the question, and you guys wanted to be first at that.
Well, it almost seems trivial, you know, when I wrote about it, but it was very, very important. It's one of the techniques of broadcasting. It's known as you super the person's name. You superimpose the name of the person, whether it's the Secretary of State. In this case, it was supering the names of all the reporters who stood up to ask questions of the president. And all three networks tried their best to stay right with the questioning and right with the questioner's answer. And it was not until Sandy Sokolow replaced Bill Small that they developed an electronic system where each time a new reporter would stand up, boom, he'd hit a certain button and up would come his name. Hmm. And after that, we won it every time.
And you were competitive about that as well, just as well as getting a story.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, the name of the book is The Place to Be, Washington, CBS, and the Glory Days of Television News. My guest today is Roger Mudd, who's a big part of the CBS through the 60s, 70s, and ending in 1980, then eventually went to NBC and had a distinguished career there, and PBS as well. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. When we think of your reporting, certainly great reporting. You did the CBS Saturday Evening News, but I think of some of the legacy of your best reporting was your work with the Kennedys. You became associated with the Kennedys, although you write in the book, you said, I really don't know why that happened, but it certainly happened. First with Robert Kennedy, and then, of course, the famous interview with Ted Kennedy when he ran for the Democratic nomination in 1980 against then-incumbent President Jimmy Carter. How did the relationship form with the Kennedys?
Well, I first met Robert Kennedy when he was chief counsel of the Senate Rackets Committee, and they were investigating the Teamsters, Jimmy Hoffa. And I was working for the local CBS station, and we covered those hearings live, and so I met him there and met his wife there, and at one point we were invited, I guess after I'd gone to CBS, invited to dinner at their house. in McLean, Virginia, and we don't live too far away. But anyway, it was a lot of fun to be invited to a dinner at the Kennedys, because there was a lot of laughing and just a lot of interesting people came through. And that, my wife and I were friends with that very limited branch of the Kennedy family. I did not know John Kennedy and did not know Edward Ted Kennedy until some time later. But I covered both of them as senators, as I should have, assigned to the Senate. And I covered the Kennedy campaign of 1968 and the assassination and all that followed there, his death. And I did an hour broadcast about him. He told me later, he said, "I keep reading you're supposed to be a friend of the Kennedy family, but I'm not so sure after seeing that hour." And then several years later, a decade later, when Ted Kennedy was making his big move for the presidency, we did another hour with him. And my relationship with him was quite different than it was with Robert Kennedy, simply because I had not known him as long and had not been socially with him at all, really. So that was a different kind of broadcast. And I think what it revealed at the time was that he, in fact, had not spent a lot of time thinking about why he wanted to be president, and it was revealed in that broadcast. So it wasn't that broadcast ended his presidential career. It certainly didn't help him.
And, of course, it was the question. And the question, as you write in the book, it was the slowest of slow pitch that he should have been able to knock out of. Did you have any qualms about just asking that question? Because it's such an obvious sort of softball question. Why do you want to be president? Did you have any qualms about asking that?
No qualms at all. I was really mystified, because I had, in the preceding Q&A leading up to that point, I kept trying to find out how he differed, in what major way he differed from Jimmy Carter. And nothing came through that it impressed me with a sufficient reason for a Democratic senator to try to unseat a sitting Democratic president from your own party. And I finally, almost mystified, say, "Well, but why do you want to be president?" That's what it came from. And then what followed was, you know, that 350-word answer, which was...
not an answer.
Well, it wasn't an answer, no, because I don't think he'd ever been asked that. Certainly had never asked himself that, because it was, I don't mean to say it was gibberish, but it bordered on the nonsensical.
And you write in the book, as the answer went on, you know, I'm sure you kept your jaw in place, but inside your head, the jaw was dropping, was it?
Well, it was. We were very worried that we didn't have a very good program with him, because his stuff was, you know, so sort of mushy, and we kept, you know, this was shot on film, not videotape, and so you had to stop and change, put on a new magazine every 20 minutes, and between breaks, we'd go off, the producers and I would go off and say, "Oh boy, this is tough. I don't know, we got a show." And it wasn't until the film was developed and you saw it in the screening room in New York, quiet room, all the doors closed, no distractions of airplanes, and you saw this close-up of this marvelous head of Kennedy groping for some reasonable explanation of why he was there and what he wanted to do, and you realize that you were seeing some stuff that nobody else had ever seen. And so that's what made it so interesting, was this was a side of Kennedy that the public had never seen before.
Hmm. Well, it's a fascinating account of your time at CBS, the place to be. Roger Mudd, thanks very much for your time. I've enjoyed it greatly.
Delighted I got to talk to you.
Veteran television journalist and newscaster Roger Mudd speaking with us back in 2008 here on Studio Tulsa. Mudd died last week at the age of 93. He spent over three decades working for CBS, NBC, and PBS. Here's the comments of Mark Dara.
My mother collected John F. Kennedy's silver half dollars to fund a family vacation back east. She saved the coins even after they became mostly copper. It would take a lot of half dollars to pay for the trip she wanted to make. our family wasn't flush. In the summer of 1971, my mother, father, brother, sister, and I got into a emerald green Plymouth sedan with a white vinyl top. Dad started the car and took us on a journey of 17 states, with time in Philadelphia, New York, Boston, Washington, D.C., and on the Maine coast. We passed by the St. Louis Arch, visited Lincoln's home in Springfield, Illinois, and toured the Hershey's Chocolate Factory in Pennsylvania, among other things. My father studied maps and counted miles. He was certainly the road manager, but my mother was the impresario, our own master of space, time, and means. New York City posed a challenge for us small-town, small-city Oklahomans. How does one find where to go in a big metropolis if you don't know where you are going? Dad drove the distinctive Plymouth sedan through Lincoln Tunnel, located the first available parking garage, and left the vehicle there. We found a place to buy tickets and took a Grey Line bus tour of Gotham. I don't remember much from that day, but I recall the city as overwhelmingly gray and not the delightful place of beautiful people I had imagined from television, movies, and books. Gray can be an elegant color, but the gray I remember from that New York visit was dismal. In a best-selling erotic novel title, gray serves as a euphemism for screwed up, which serves as a euphemism for, well, you know. Really, though, gray is a non-committal color. If we refuse to say whether something is right or wrong, we say it's in a gray area. You can wear gray, and any other color goes with it. If your car is gray, you won't scare away any potential buyer because of its garish color, but you might have trouble locating your vehicle in a crowded parking lot. Gray is the beige of this generation. It's boring at best and dismal at worst. Adventurous see life in colors, not in grays. When former Tulsa Mayor LaFortune announced his vision for what would become the BOK Center, he said he wanted the structure to be iconic. Iconic? Probably not. But Tulsa ended up with a brilliant, shiny, unique, memorable, and magnificent edifice that helped start a renaissance of our downtown. A visitor gone for 10 years might struggle to recognize a familiar street view there today. Yet the next time you visit downtown Tulsa, count the number of gray box buildings. They seem to multiply by some kind of architectural cell division. Owners and developers, there are thousands of other designs and hues. Be bold. Why go straight when you can go jagged or curved? Try boldly vivid. Remember, gray is the twilight color that knows neither victory nor defeat. After our parents died, my brother, sister, and I went through our mother and father's home. We found jars and jars, cans and boxes full of John F. Kennedy half dollars. We never knew where our mother came up with the money to finance our Technicolor car trip back east.
Mark Dare is a local attorney and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.